You're listening to the Exploring Research Careers podcast, the podcast that talks to people about their research careers and also explores personal histories of those who support researchers. In this episode of Exploring Research Careers podcast, I speak with Dr. Larissa Floria. Dr. Floria studied organic chemistry and chemical engineering at University Polytechnica, Romania. In 2009, she joined the Adaptive Sensors Group at Dublin City University, where she earned her PhD in materials chemistry. In today's episode, we talk to her about how she felt supported and developed through her student and postdoc years, and how that has impacted her own support of her PhD students and postdocs. She talks us through the emotional journey of applying for an ERC grant, being rejected, reapplying, and being awarded the starter grant second time round. You're so welcome, Larissa. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to start the podcast off in the usual way, which is the conversation around PhD. Were you always thinking of a PhD? Did you have a plan for after? Had you had a thought process around that? What were you thinking?
Yes, I think I kind of always wanted to do a PhD. I had a lot of mentors in my teachers and my professors, especially during university. And because I was admiring them so much, I kind of wanted to have the opportunity to become a mentor myself. So I think this is what really pushed me to do a PhD, the opportunity of having an academic career at the end of it.
That sounds like it was all focused on the people.
Yes, yes, definitely.
So what about the science or the subject?
So the subject came to me very quickly, I would say, in my life. So I'm Romanian. In Romania, we start learning chemistry from when we are about 12. And in Romania, just like in a lot of Eastern European countries, there is really a focus on Olympiads. So we have a lot of national competitions, and I just loved chemistry. I had a great teacher. She was doing a lot of very interesting experiments, and she realized very quickly that I really enjoy it, and she asked me if I would like to participate in the Olympiads. And this is how it started, really. For a couple of times, I was the first one in the country. So it kind of really just started from there. And I knew there was no way back. This was going to be my career one way or another, I guess.
So talk us through then, as you go through your PhD and finishing up, were you, like you've already mentioned, yeah, I was probably thinking along the lines of what I was seeing. You know, the academics who are around me. What were you thinking as you were finishing up your PhD?
So before I actually even started my PhD, I came to Ireland for an internship in the same group where I was going to do later on my PhD.
How did Ireland come into the picture?
Well, I applied for a lot of different fellowships all over the world. I knew early on that if I wanted to have a successful career in research, I should probably go abroad, at least to experience how research is done in other countries that maybe have more research funding compared to Romania. So that's when I applied for a couple of different internships, and I obtained this one that was organized in Dublin City University. So I came for 3 months over the summer during my third year in university. And I worked in the group, I loved it, and I applied later on, so the following year, for an Irish Research Council PhD position, PhD fellowship, and I was lucky enough to get it, so I started the PhD in the same group.
Wow.
Yeah, so I guess I was always quite driven towards this career, so I kind of, maybe looking back, I think I was quite lucky in taking the right steps towards this goal. So applying for a lot of different internships, applying for a PhD position very early on.
Who had told you to do that, or how did you know to do that?
I had good advisors during my university years. So again, it really came from this desire to get the support, the appreciation, and the support of my professors, because I thought they were so amazing in what they were doing, and obviously they were working very long hours and maybe not getting, you know, the best financial contribution for all their work, but they were really inspiring, and I always wanted, I guess, the approval of my professors and teachers, and I was working towards that goal.
Okay. So then skip to towards the end of your PhD, what's happening?
So towards the end of my PhD, I was quite aware of all of the different steps I would need to take in order to have a chance of an academic position. Even before I finished my PhD, I was lucky enough to have a lot of independence during my PhD. So this meant that I really had to take ownership of my work. So this meant the good and the bad. So it meant that when the research went well, everything was obviously great and I got a lot of results, but also when the research was not going so well, I was the one accountable and responsible for that. So I was aware of all the steps I would need to take, and if I wanted to go into academia, I knew that I would have to apply for a lot of fellowships, for a lot of postdoc positions in order to achieve that goal. So I knew what are the criteria that were important for that. I knew I needed a certain number of publications. I knew I needed international experience. So I was lucky enough to go on secondments in different groups around the world to gain more experience and to kind of try to get more experience in different fields, not sure. Necessarily just in the subject that I was focusing on. So once I got to the end,
I guess you didn't seem put off by all of that you would have to do all of those things.
No, but in the same time, I knew that, for example, towards the end of my PhD and also in the first few years of my postdoc, I went to a lot of these career days for early career researchers. And you become aware of the statistics associated with an academic career. You are aware that maybe 10% of people who have a PhD in Ireland will end up having an academic career. You know that if you don't get your independent funding within the first 5 years after your PhD, that the chances of getting an academic position become lower and lower. So I kind of gave myself a time limit to achieve some of these goals. And I knew that if I don't manage within this time frame, it doesn't mean that I'm not good enough to ever get an academic position, but I knew that my chances would become a lot smaller and I should probably then look into something else. And industry, I mean, it's not a bad option. In many ways, it's a better option, I think, than academia. But this was kind of my plan. And I was quite focused on this career path.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask you, if you ever considered anything else, but I guess you seem to be quite aware of the things that you've had to achieve in order to get to where you are.
Yes, I think I was lucky in that way. My PhD supervisor had done a fantastic job in really allowing me to experience, to go to different conferences, to be part of important meetings, to contribute to proposals and so on. So I became aware very early on of what are the requirements and what does this career involve. And I wanted to give it my best chance, but I am aware even, I mean, I have a lot of friends and co-workers that have done maybe a PhD with me or a postdoc with me, and I think they're brilliant, but maybe they didn't achieve an academic position, even though maybe that was one of their maybe initial thoughts. But they are doing very well in industry, and you know, you can still get a lot of satisfaction of getting research in industry. It doesn't necessarily need to be in academia.
But can I ask you, if when you moved into your postdoc position, did you feel that, did you notice there was a big difference in your day to day, or how did that feel when you moved into that position after your PhD?
I think it depends in terms of how was your PhD position. So if you were given a lot of independence and if you had to manage your own time and kind of figuring out your own ideas and writing your own papers, maybe the first postdoc position is not such a big difference from your last years of PhD, for example. However, I think all postdocs positions require a great deal of independence. You are assumed to be at a certain level where you are capable of, you know, deciding what ideas are worth pursuing, where do you see the research going, where do you see this research getting published? So it does require a lot of independence and you have a lot of ownership of your own work. So maybe in your first few years of a PhD, you could say, this is what my supervisor told me to do, or this is, I did what you told me and this is not working. This doesn't work when you are a postdoc. You are pursuing your own ideas most of the time.
Can you talk a little bit about how the move to Trinity happened?
So since 2017, I started applying for independent research grants with Trinity as the host institution, because obviously Trinity has a very good reputation and is the highest ranked university in Ireland. So it would increase your chances when applying for independent research grants. So since 2017, I started applying with Trinity as a host. I got a lot of support from the School of Chemistry and from the Amber Center. And I was successful in one of these applications and I moved to Trinity.
Ah, very good. So we're going to talk about that a little bit later on in terms of applying for grants. In the meantime, I suppose, as you're moving on in your career and you're taking on more responsibility, you became, or you are, an Athena Swan champion. I'm just curious to know what that actually means.
Yes. So just to give a little bit of context, Athena Swan Charter is a charter that was established in 2015 in the UK. And it's currently used in many countries around the globe to basically address gender equality within higher education and research. And it basically supports equality of opportunity regardless of gender. And I'm passionate about equal visibility of role models. And I think it's really important to have diversity in our role models and diversity in academia. And gender balance is something that we are struggling with, in maybe not in all fields, but definitely in some fields more than in others. And it's not necessarily an issue that we have created, but it's one that we have inherited. So we have to try to find ways of really changing this and improving it so that young girls coming into school, they don't really have a feeling about, you know, I have to pursue maybe a career in this field compared to this field. They should have equality of opportunity, regardless of the gender, economic background, social background, and so on.
And as a champion, what do you actually do?
So what we are actually doing, and it's not just me, is the whole Athena Swan committee that we have in the school. We look at the environment of the school. So, for example, we organize surveys and we ask people about the culture in the school. Do they consider the culture, the school, as being a friendly environment? Do they consider it collaborative, inclusive? We ask about the work-life balance. How much time do they spend reading emails out of working hours? Do they feel pressure responding to emails from their boss, for example, or their supervisor outside of the working hours? So we're really trying to look at all of these different categories and really ask ourselves, what can we do to improve the quality of the life of our staff and students? Because this means that they will perform better, they will be happier. And I mean, looking at the PhD students, for example, obviously, it's a stressful environment. Doing a PhD, it's stressful in many ways because it's a lot of pressure on yourself. It's everything is new. You're spending most of your time doing things that do not work. You really want to ensure that you're doing your best so that the students feel welcome in the school. They feel supported. They know that it's difficult to do a PhD, but they know that if they have questions, if they feel overwhelmed, they have somebody to ask, they feel it's secure, it's a secure environment. So this is what we're trying to do with the Athena Swan Charter.
I suppose I'm curious about, is there a lot of extra work involved in being on such a committee or being a champion?
It is, but in our school, basically every member of the school, every member of staff has these additional responsibilities. Maybe some are involved in, you know, improving the curriculum or maybe in mentoring undergraduate students. So you do have these extra activities. And in my case, this involves being a part of the Athena Swan Committee and contributing to the equality and diversity and inclusion of our school. But we all have these activities that are not research nor teaching. So it's just part of the academic mm-hmm. position.
Yeah. In the notes that you sent me, you talk about that you have been a mentor to students. Can you talk a little bit about what you personally get out of mentoring? Because I know from experience from working with some students and even a staff, they're afraid to approach a person to be a mentor. They might think, oh, they're too busy. You know, it's too much of a drag for them. I'll get a lot out of it. They won't. What do you get out of being a mentor?
Mentoring is definitely a tough job, but This discussion started with me saying how important mentors were in my life. And I guess I never thought so much if you get the satisfaction from mentoring before I became a mentor. It's definitely a difficult task. But I think it's human nature to really get satisfaction out of helping people. I think we all love to help people, and when people are succeeding, even maybe you contributed at a very small extent to their success, but that gives you satisfaction. And I think this is maybe a common trait that you'll find with people who choose a career in academia, that you are genuinely very happy for the success of your students, the people you mentor.
Is there a more tangible impact, or is it that kind of, you know, feel good factor?
I mean, strictly speaking, from my point of view, obviously the success of my PhD students is also my success.
Sure.
If they get publications, I get publications. If they get successful projects, I am part of the successful project as well. So in that case, absolutely, we are helping.
I just think it's important to highlight, because there could be people listening going, oh, I didn't realize actually that if I'm successful, they also can benefit from that success. You know, sometimes people have a kind of an imbalanced view, especially if there might be a student or a bit younger, you know.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So you're trying, as a supervisor, you're obviously trying your best to help your students become successful. But of course, this also means that your grants are successful, that you increase your chances when you're applying for the next grant to get it, because you have shown you can do this, you can be a good supervisor, and you can have and you have results to show that, demonstrate that.
That's brilliant. I want to move on to a part of the episode, if that's okay, to talk about you and your application, because you've won an ERC starter grant. And I know, you know, some people might be really, really interested in this and what it was like and the emotional journey of kind of applying, because sometimes people seem fearful or they're like, oh, I'm not ready for that. You know, can you talk us through your experience and your journey around that?
Definitely. I was very lucky, obviously, in getting an ERC. And I would say I did apply before I was ready. And I think that's important. Really start early before you think you're ready, even. Because once you start putting work into it and developing your ideas and working towards, you know, the whole of the idea, you get better and better. So it is definitely a process. And it was the same for me. I was encouraged by...
Can I ask you before you launch into this, you know, you're saying it's good to start early. So was there an anxiety around that for you?
Oh, absolutely. There was definitely an anxiety. But I was then part of a different research center, Insight Research Center, and like all the research centers in Ireland, it has a lot of support, people who support you in applying for grants. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And this is how really it started. And I had a good CV for a postdoc, and they were interested in finding people that could potentially apply for an ERC. And this is really how it started. And at first I thought, no, I'm not ready. I barely qualified to apply for it, because I believe at the time it was between, you could apply between 2 and 7 years after your PhD. And I think I was like 2 years and a little bit after. And I knew that the chances of getting one just so early on after your PhD are very small. But I thought, okay, if you think it's worth a try, I think it's worth a try as well. And they really helped me, and they organized for my proposals, for the drafts on my proposal to be read by different consultancy companies. And also inside the department.
Did you know all of that before you started preparing? Was that kind of a positive? Were you thinking, I'm going to have a lot of support while I do this? They're going to get this kind of support? Or were you thinking, was it like, How did that happen?
I knew that I would have to prepare these drafts very early on, because they need to be to a certain standard before they can be read and reviewed. So maybe I was, I think for the first draft, I was away on my summer holidays to Romania after not seeing my family for almost a year. But I needed to, you know, stay for those few days before I submit the draft to a consultancy firm to read it, because I knew it has to be at a certain standard. There's no point in sending something that is at a very low level, because you're going to get very little out of it. So, Yes, I knew I was going to get support, but I knew that I was the only one who was going to, put in the long hours in order to get something out of it. But I was willing to try anyway.
And so, okay, so you're getting support, you're giving your proposal to consultants to kind of critique, and you send it through?
Yes, and eventually, so the good part was that I started really early. So it meant that I had quite a few months to write it and get it to a good level. And to my surprise, I was accepted for the second round, which is the interview round. So the ERC works in two rounds. The first one is just the written report, so mm-hmm. your application.
So that went through and you were accepted. So what was that like to get that kind of, you know, to get the response going, yes, you're gone through the first round?
That was really exciting. Very, very excited about. I was very, very excited about that. Because first of all, it was a little bit unexpected. I mean, I knew it was so competitive. I wasn't sure if I was going to, even get to that state. And also, the rules of the ERC are that if you don't get to the second round, you cannot apply the following year. So when I applied for the first time only 2 and a little bit years after my PhD, I knew that if I don't do a good enough job to get to the interview, I'm even denied the opportunity of applying the following year. So I was delighted that I got to the interview. But of course, then even more preparation began. And obviously, no reviewing process is perfect. Now I am also a reviewer myself for different applications. And in this type of two-stage review process, my feeling is that, yes, you do get to the interview, but if your initial scores for your report, yes, for your written application are not high enough, even, I think, even if you do amazingly well in the interview, you're still not going to change those reports, those reviewers' reports that are already written. But what you can change is if you're kind of in between, maybe your scores are not like top of the top, but not just above the threshold either, then maybe you can have an influence to the final result. So if you knew maybe that going in the interview, you have like already achieved a score of, I don't know, a certain percentage, maybe you would know better how to present yourself during the interview.
But do you not know that?
You do not know that, no.
Okay.
And at the end of the interview process, basically you get two reviews. One about the interview itself and one for the
application
for the written and application.
Can I ask you, Larissa, like going into that meeting, what was that like for you as a person?
So it is stressful.
How did you prepare? Did you just stand and talk about your research and your project to as many people who would listen and get them to ask you questions?
Yes, kind of like that. I had a lot of mock interviews organized. And I think it's great to be part of mock interviews, absolutely. But I also think that examiners that go in a mock interview, a lot of them try to become the worst type of examiner that you can encounter.
The bad cop.
Exactly. So I think that after a few mock interviews, you feel like, oh, this real interview is going to be full of this type of examiners, which of course, in reality, it's very unlikely. So mock interviews are very good for preparing you for the worst. but in the same time can really affect your confidence.
Okay.
Because you are like, you know,
afraid of your life.
Yes, and constantly defending and constantly being basically put into the most difficult situation. Of course, you do hear sometimes that these things can happen sometimes, rarely, in official interviews as well. But it's different when it's, you know, one out of the many examples.
What was it like when you got in there then? Was it kind of nicer than you expected?
Oh, yes, it was really nice. Very nice atmosphere. And I thought, to be honest, before I went into the interview room, I thought at the end of the interview, I would know where I'm standing. But I didn't, because okay. Everyone asks all the questions in a very polite way. They do give you the opportunity to answer. You know, it's a very pleasant interview, a very pleasant conversation. So you don't really know when you're exiting the room if you're going to get the grant or not. And sometimes, actually, the examiners who are holding the interview don't know either until, you know, all the interviews are done and all the scoring is done and you're finally in a certain...
How did you feel when you were leaving the room?
I thought I did well. I thought I was happy that I didn't remember saying any silly thing, didn't make mistakes. I thought that the questions were okay. So I was happy with that, because sometimes, especially, for example, in the mock interviews, I think many times I would have thought, oh, I should have given a different answer, or I should have looked at that from a different angle.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, it all makes sense in retrospect. But for the interview itself, I thought it was okay. I didn't really have any thoughts that I couldn't get rid of, you know, like you do have sometimes.
And what was the outcome of that? What happened then?
So, unfortunately, I wasn't successful in that year. It was disappointing, but then again, it was the first time I was applying. And I knew from other people who went through the same process that, you know, the success rate is small. I was hopeful, obviously, but it was... it was the biggest kind of independent award that I would qualify at that stage in my career. And I thought...
I suppose when you think about all the work and all the prep, all the preparation you'd put yourself through, I mean, I can hear you saying that you were disappointed, but I mean, I think you must have been gutted to think of all of the work and all of the support and everyone kind of, you know, come on.
Yes, definitely. You feel disappointed. I mean, I knew from my mentors, very successful academics, that, I mean, I knew they were very successful. I could see they were very successful. And they would tell me that their success rate when applying for grants is about 20% at most. So this meant that they were writing 10 very good grants to only get 2.
Yeah.
So, of course, rejection hurts. I mean, it's normal, especially because, as you say, you put a lot of effort into it.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, the amount of effort you put into it, it's not, unfortunately, no guarantee of success.
Yeah.
So you have to go through the motions, have to try your best, and then just it's a bit of a chance as well. But at least...
Because you got to the second round, you were now able to apply again for the following year.
Exactly.
Was that as nerve-wracking and as challenging emotionally? And I'm saying emotionally because, you know, I'm thinking about people who might be listening. you know, and think, God, you know, if it's a student or an undergrad or something, thinking one day I'd like to apply for an ERC. But you seem, there is a part of you, it kind of seems to take it in your stride.
Well, I mean, I'm sure at the time it might not, it didn't feel that way. I was, I'm sure, very disappointed. And the second time, you know, I thought about, will I apply this year? And I thought, I have to apply.
Why?
Well, because I was allowed to, first of all. And second, I thought that because I received the feedback, and the feedback was quite good, even for the written report. And during that year, I managed to get some more results and kind of focus my ideas a little bit better and look at things from a different angle. And I kind of realized what were the weaknesses in the first application. Mm-hmm. And I knew that if I applied two consecutive years, I will not get the same group of reviewers to look at my proposal. So now the proposal will be seen again with fresh eyes by reviewers where none of them have seen it before.
Okay.
Because every second year in this particular program, they bring back reviewers from previous years.
Okay.
So then it means that if you apply, let's say, in 2018 and then you apply again in 2020, it's very likely that some of the reviewers will be the same. So some people will read, you know, the different proposals or maybe a modified proposal twice. So I thought, okay, it's a good opportunity. Before, in the first round, this was the number of people that thought it was good. I thought, okay, I can improve it a little bit and then make all the changes and everything. And I applied again. So I was luckier the second time. And again,
yeah, you've used that word a few times. Look, and I'm sure, I suppose I'm thinking about one of the episodes we recorded, and there was a little bit on it about imposter syndrome. And, you know, I'm thinking, I mean, you do agree that you put an awful lot of work and effort in and you still are working very hard. So do you think it's lucky that you got through a second time after going through that the first time?
Well, maybe it's a lot of work and maybe a little bit of luck. But yeah. Definitely, maybe luck is not the greatest word to use, but maybe a little bit of chance. I think you always need to have some things working for you.
For example, I know what you mean. Yeah.
For example, I would have applied before. I would have been involved before in applications where you are obviously putting a lot of effort into the application. But then at the end of the call, you find out that the success rate was 1%. You got a very good score, well above the threshold. But because of the funding that was available and the number of applications that was received by the program, the success rate was 1%. That means not having the chance. You know, if the success rate would have been 5%, you would have got it. But at 1%, your proposal, your idea, the way you wrote the proposal was not in the top 1%. So
feel as anxious going in for the second interview as you did for the first?
Yes, definitely. Probably more. Because I thought, if this time is the same, and again, you're going in without really knowing what the reviewers thought about your application. So you don't know what to expect. But again, a lot of mock interviews, again, a lot of challenges, yes. But You go in, you try, and you just, you don't know how it's going to go. It's very short, normally just about 25 minutes, 10 minutes for a presentation. It really depends on the specific specific interview topic. So for ERC, we have a lot of different sections. And depending, for example, if you are in a chemistry section or in an engineering section, you might get different amounts of time for the interview.
Okay.
For the specific panel, this is the word that I was looking for. For my specific panel, I had 10-minute presentation, and then I think 15 or 20 minutes for the interview. Okay. So the first part is the part that you can really polish and prepare and practice a lot, the presentation. And then the next 20 minutes is really, it really depends on the questions.
Yeah. And then you obviously got a positive then on the second application. So talk us through what that felt like.
That was amazing. It was really exciting to open the email and see that you were successful.
Did you know before you opened the email whether it was positive or negative? Did it give any indication?
No indication at all. Okay. So it was just after I opened the email, the communication, and I saw that I was successful. I was really, really happy. Of course.
Were you the first to find out, or did anyone else find out before you?
I think when they send you the email, they also send the email to the host institution. So the people from the research office,
they would know as well.
Yes, they would know as well. But yes, I opened it straight away, and it was a great, great moment. You kind of forget all the hard work after you get such a success.
When you got the positive out, you know, the email to say you've achieved this and you've won this, at what point then, how long is it before you start working on that project?
So in my case was really very soon that I started to work on the project. But you do have the chance to postpone the start date. You have, I believe, maybe something like 6 months. During this time frame, let's say 6 months, you can choose your own start date. Okay. But for me, it made sense to start early on. So I found out in like July, and I started in October.
Okay. Can I ask you what you learned about yourself going through that process?
I've learned that I can be resilient, and that sometimes you just have to take criticism and just try to improve. And you just learn. And I think this is also something you kind of learn during your PhD, that regardless of what challenges you're confronted with, you're probably going to find a way. There's always you have the abilities to overcome whatever you can, you know, whatever is thrown at you, you can overcome it. And you know that things are going to be okay. And obviously it's great to get success, and it's really great to see that all your hard work has paid off. But in the same time, you could have done all of those things in exactly the same way. But if the success rate, for example, would have been different, you would have been one of the unsuccessful ones. So it means that you have to put in all of the hard work and the long working hours just so that you can say at the end that you have tried your best. Now, if the success comes, that is fantastic, and it will come. If you do this all the time, statistically, you have to have also successful grants. But doing everything right is not a guarantee that you will get it.
Mm-hmm. What advice would you have for people who might be listening who are thinking about doing a PhD?
I would definitely say, think why you want to do a PhD. Obviously, in Ireland, for example, we have a lot of PhD fellowships, a lot of possibilities for doing a PhD. But a PhD is a huge commitment, not only financially, because obviously a PhD stipend does not compare with the salary that you would get in industry. But it also means a lot of emotional commitment as well, because you need to really learn a lot, but also it's a type of work that you are responsible for. It's not really your supervisor, it's something that you're doing for yourself. So think why you want to do this. If your dream is to have an academic career, of course, this is the only way towards that goal. You need to get a PhD. But if your goal is maybe to have a certain position in industry or something else, maybe think, are you committed to 4 or more years in a research environment? If, for example, you just love to learn and you're really interested in research, you have done, for example, a fourth year project or a third year project, and you really want to give it a good try, that is not a bad reason. But you just kind of need to be aware of what are your possibilities at the end, and do you commit to this studies for another 4 years? Because it's not really a job; it's a degree, and you're doing it for yourself.
Mm-hmm. For postdocs who might be listening, say someone who's just finished their PhD, what kind of advice would you give them, or what would you say to them?
Again, be aware of the landscape and what your goals are. And really read a few articles, look at the statistics, look at what you need to achieve at this current time in order to get what you want. Maybe the worst that can happen is that you go from a postdoc position to another postdoc position without a real goal. And also give yourself a certain time frame. Give yourself a deadline. Think, okay, I'm going to really try my best to achieve this for the next 3, 4, 5, 6 years. But maybe being a postdoc for 15 years is not really practical. It might work in some countries where you have independent research centers, for example, where you can be a postdoc for as long as you want, but maybe not in Ireland. So really think about where do you see yourself, and be realistic and give yourself a realistic time frame to achieve what you would like.
We're just coming up to the end, and I don't know whether you want to add about your own personal lessons learned over the years. Do you have anything you want to add to that, Larissa?
What I've learned, I guess, is that you have to be informed. I think being informed is very important. And I think working in a scientific field, you really have to believe in the statistics that are out there and use them to help you in pursuing your goals, but also in kind of keeping you grounded. So in my case, I knew what I would need to do in order to have an opportunity for the career that I wanted.
Okay.
But I also knew that if by this given deadline I will not achieve this, I should not pursue it endlessly, because it will never be in my advantage. And this is also what I advise the PhD students, but especially the postdocs that work with me. I try to ask them very early on what they would like to achieve. What is the career that they see themselves doing for, you know, a good part of their life? And depending on that answer, I try to think, okay, these are some of the opportunities that you should take straight away. You should maybe go on secondments to some of our collaborators. You should really focus on achieving this number of first author publications. You should apply for all of these independent fellowships.
In some ways, it seems like quite a brave move to, because you mentioned about, you know, putting a time limit on yourself and being aware of those opportunities. But if you haven't hit the mark at year five, and it's a brave move to say, okay, I aren't where I want to be. I'm going to start looking at industry. Now, I know people who've done that, and they're very happy now that they've made that move. But like you've invested a lot into that pathway.
You have invested a lot into that pathway, but that doesn't mean that is the only pathway you can take. And when one of my PhD students, after graduation, they told me that they definitely don't want a career in academia. Actually, a lot of people after their PhD, they would really know they don't want to do that for the rest of their life, or being involved in that career, being PhD supervisor and so on. And they went for an interview with Intel because they wanted a job in industry. And what they told them was, because we helped them prepare for the interview, and we really thought it's going to be very specific about the technical procedure that was going to be used in their job. And they were saying, actually, a PhD means for us the ability to learn, that you can learn anything. It's a stamp that you can learn anything. And I think this is really what a PhD is, because it's a new field. These things haven't been done before. It's something that you, as an individual, bring to this field. So you're doing all of the research, you're reading all of these papers, you have to come up with your own idea. And if you can do that in this very tiny field, it means that you can do this in any little field. I think I'm a big believer that anything can be learned. And I think that is really what a PhD is.
Larissa, it's been so lovely talking to you. Thank you so much for your time. I don't know if you want to add anything else, but it's been just so interesting. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I really hope this will help some of your listeners. And thank you so much for making me a part of this journey.
Thanks so much. We've come to the end of this episode of our podcast, Exploring Research Careers. If you like the podcast, maybe you want to tell your friends and colleagues, or anyone who you think might get benefit from listening to the conversations. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at @Eeyore_careers, where you can find new episodes as they're released. In the meantime, thanks for listening and take care.